Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We learned kind of quickly on through that process that Disney, Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, and Lucasfilms didn't really love our plans, and so they ended up suing us, and we had to pivot a lot faster to our original content strategy than we were even hoping. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, I'm destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, I've got on another brilliant guest. He is the co-founder and president of Angel Studios, the same studio that brought you awesome movies like The Sound of Freedom. And this is Jordan Harmon. Welcome to the show, man.
Man, thanks for having me. It's good to see you.
Jordan, I've done a brief intro there, but for people who are not familiar, please introduce yourself.
Yeah. So, you know, we grew up in Burley, Idaho, and we started a company as four brothers called Angel Studios, known for, you know, fun stand-up comedy like Dry Bar Comedy. Obviously, the big smash hit Sound of Freedom last year. We had an incredible documentary that went to theaters called After Death. It was the number one faith documentary in the entire theatrical release history. And upcoming right now on July 4th, we have a follow-up to Sound of Freedom called Sound of Hope, which is telling the incredible story of 22 families who adopted 77 kids in Possum Trot, Texas. This story is absolutely remarkable because it truly nails into the power of the individual, and it nails into the power of solving this foster crisis, because 90% of the kids that are found through sex trafficking in the United States, 90% have been in the foster system. When we learned this, we knew this film had to get out to the world.
Awesome. We all know that in today's fast-paced world, it's harder than ever to live a healthy lifestyle. Just about everyone is struggling with gut issues, stress, inflammation, fatigue, or immune issues. Most of it comes down to diet, but getting nutrient-rich food consistently isn't always easy or affordable. With hectic schedules, processed foods, and the rising cost of healthy options, we all need a cheat code as the game of life gets more difficult. My cheat code is Optimal Human. With over 90 ingredients, including powerful vitamins and other nutrients, one serving of Optimal Human helps me fulfill my daily nutritional needs. And in my opinion, it tastes better than many of the other green supplements on the market. Optimal Human contains powerful superfoods like organic reishi mushroom for your brain, turmeric root for your joints, beetroot for cardiovascular health, CoQ10 for cellular health, and probiotics for gut health. It's simple to integrate into your daily life. Just add one scoop to water, a smoothie, or your protein shake and get an instant, delicious nutrient boost. Try Optimal Human today and get 50% off your first month by going to optimalhuman.com/Zuby. That's optimalhuman.com/Zuby, and you'll get 50% off your first month. Go check it out. I want to talk about the movie soon, but let's run it back a little bit, man. Tell me a little bit more about your own background. So tell me more about your childhood and
Idaho
up
potatoes.
With all those brothers.
Yeah. So there's nine siblings. It's a very small family, three girls and six boys. I'm number eight of nine. And, you know, we grew up in a very unique experience. I think if people looked at our growing up years from the outside looking in, they would probably say it was a pretty difficult growing up, but I actually think it was one of the most blessed childhoods you could ever have. We were very important. You know, there's your median income, your poverty line. And then we were way down below that, in terms of where we were. We weren't actually farmers. My father lost his farm a little earlier on in life, And so we worked for the farmers with a lot of the migrant workers. And it was an incredible experience because we learned to work. I learned I didn't want to be a farmer for my occupation, but we also just learned to help rally together as siblings to provide for the family and help my parents wherever they needed it. And so it was such a unique experience. I remember, you know, very early on us going and taking 50 pound boxes of Idaho potato boxes. This is my brother Jeff's idea, one of the other co-founders, and then transporting those all the way to Utah in a big 15 passenger van and selling those door to door to Utah citizens saying, hey, you know, we're selling Idaho potatoes because, you know, that's what Idaho's known for. And we would do really well. I mean, all of a sudden it was like, holy smokes, I can go make, you know, $30, $40, $50 an hour if I work really hard at this. And that was, I think, man, the first time I went door to door selling potatoes was probably 10 years old. And so it's just, it's been a, something about our growing up years kind of infused in us the desire to start companies and to be entrepreneurs and to try new things and take risks. Some would say that like our upbringing broke our risk barometer. I mean, we just don't have one. But it was a remarkable experience. My parents, I had the greatest privilege of all time in that I had two loving parents, a father and a mother who loved and cared about me. So years later, we've started multiple companies throughout the years with different siblings being involved in different ones. I ended up starting a DIY home security company called Cove that we grew into a $100 million company. And my brothers, Neil, Jeff, Daniel, and I, and a cousin, Benton, started Angel Studios, man, over 10 years ago now. And the goal was, as we were looking at the entertainment landscape, we were seeing that there was a speed at which the entertainment industry was going away from what we considered the values we wanted for our kids. We've got quite a few kids between all of us. Between the nine siblings, there's, I think, 57 grandkids. So it's a house full.
That's
but
that's
the my wife's due at number six right now. But the July 7th is the due date. But the we decided to stop complaining about where the entertainment industry it was and see if we could create a product, which originally was VidAngel, that would allow for all families to come together in a unique community that wanted to potentially skip or mute any inappropriate content in what they saw in their entertainment. And then once we figured once we rallied a large enough community around this product, we'd be able to launch into original content. But we learned kind of quickly on through that process that Disney, Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, and Lucasfilms didn't really love our plans. And so they ended up suing us. And we had to pivot a lot faster to our original content strategy than we were even hoping. But it ended up being a blessing in disguise because we ended up launching Dry Bar Comedy. And then our first original series for narrative was The Chosen, which, you know, a lot of people are familiar with. And then it was obviously Tuttle Twins, which is an incredible TV show for kids about freedom and economics, which is growing hyperbolically right now. I mean, it's growing 500% a year. And there's an episode on Bitcoin. There's an episode on gold. There's an episode on, you know, the inflation monster was what we call it in that TV show. And so it's fun. But I was taught, you do have a cameo in Inflation Monster. But my daughter last night was actually talking to me. She's like, hey, Dad, I realized that the Tuttle Twins TV show is totally helping me learn things that all my friends don't know. And I was like, oh, what makes you say that? She's 10. And she's like, yeah, I was talking with them and her cousins were like, how do you know what inflation is? I don't even know what that is. And she's like, well, it's the Tuttle Twins TV show. And it talks about how if you, you know, print too much or create too much money, the value of it goes down. And so you got to make sure that you're really careful about that. And so this 10-year-old is like elaborating on these really complex principles. But that's one of the things that we want to do at Angel is we want to not only enlighten the upcoming generation, but we want to tell stories that amplify light. And so it's been an absolute honor to see literally hundreds of millions of people rally behind all of our TV shows and films. And in such an impactful way, we always dreamed that we'd get to this point. But now that it's coming and hitting us, obviously there's entirely new challenges. But it's an absolute honor to be able to get these type of stories and partner with such incredible producing partners and production partners who are making these. and getting these distributed out into the world.
Man, that's incredible. There's a lot.
That was a lot there. There's a lot there. We can start dissecting it.
There's a lot of angles. Let me ask. So you started Angel Studios 10 years ago. What was it that you were seeing in the direction of mainstream entertainment, whether that is movies, television, cartoons, whatever it may be? What were the main things that were really concerning you there to the point that you were like, okay, I'm not just going to complain about this. We need to do something here.
Yeah. You know, there's a few projects that became really, really glaring. When the streaming era started, obviously you had some pretty heavy material and mature material that was just not for the family at all. Probably wasn't even for me. That really started gaining notoriety. And anybody who's studied the entertainment industry, understands that what you're seeing in entertainment predominantly today is what our culture will look like in, you know, 20, 30 years. And usually entertainment's going to be on both sides of the spectrum. It's going to be crazy, you know, I would say even evil and inappropriate stuff. And then, you know, potentially some really good material. And we want it to be more on this side to uplift and inspire society to be better. But what I kept seeing was, and I can't remember which shows they were, but some of the examples of shows that were coming out during that time period was, you know, Game of Thrones, House of Cards. Those are really great storytelling, like very, very compelling storytelling. And I don't even mind that people like watch them. It's just, it's not for me in some ways. And what I see in Game of Thrones, I don't want my society to look like, right? Like I don't want culturally for 20 years from now for us to look like what that looks like. And people find the friction and the entertainment really compelling and that's fine. But we thought, is there a way that you can get all that incredible conflict and compelling storytelling into stories that are going to uplift society in the end? And that doesn't mean that it has to be all sunrise and sunshine and rainbows. Matter of fact, anybody who saw Sound of Freedom, that is a very heavy, heavy film. It's not a film that is for the faint of heart, but at the end, it's a, you know, a positive, I believe, for culture and society. And it's driven legislation and it's driven massive support and donorship towards a lot of these nonprofits that are supporting and rescuing children and helping children. And so how do we get those stories? How do we get the ones that, and I'm fine with, you know, like I said, that there's also just escapism in the entertainment world. That's what you go to entertain yourself with. You just want to escape your mind and your life and reality. But can the escapism also be light amplifying or to the positive for the world? And so it was series like those that we just said, man, if this is what's getting crazy traction, and it's getting crazy traction because, again, Hollywood is the best storytellers in the world. There is no question that they've, you know, got a group that they've built up that's the best storytellers that have ever existed in a single spot. The storytellers will tell whatever story at the highest craft they possibly can, but they're just going to tell the stories that are greenlit by the Hollywood gatekeepers. And so what we've decided and felt very strongly about is the issue was not so much the storytellers and the producers, it was the Hollywood gatekeepers that were greenlighting the shows that maybe didn't reflect the values that we think we need for not only America, but the world. And so we've created what's called the Angel Guild that allows for the audience to come in as individuals and actually vote on every single project before it ever goes into distribution for Angel Studios. Before we can ever put our weight behind something, the Angel Guild has to say yes first. The Angel Guild's 325,000 members and growing all across 155 countries. And anybody can join the Angel Guild. It's a membership. Your membership helps fund future content. You get 2 complimentary tickets to every Angel theatrical release. But more importantly, you get a peek behind the curtain and you get to be a part of the creation process of incredible TV shows and films. And you get to be the decider of what culture should be. Because if Angel just turns around and my brothers and I create a system where we're just the new gatekeepers, we're recreating the same problem. It's not actually going to solve the problem in the long term. And we want to create a legacy company that can last as long as possible. And so, once we saw that writing on the wall, Angel Studios obviously gone for, you know, some people come to us like, I love Angel Studios. They're like, you guys are such an overnight success. I'm like, yeah, 10 year overnight success. But that being said, there is an element of this realization that, that the audience can pick winners though. The Guild, Angel Guild is picking winner after winner after winner. You look at His Only Son. Nobody wanted to pick up that film. Ends up getting top three in the box office. $250,000 film, beautiful storytelling, Sound of Freedom, massive success. After Death, a number one faith documentary in history for a theatrical release. The Shift has been a massive success. Cabrini was one of the top Catholic films, Catholic story films in history because it's such a beautiful story. And then obviously, you know, Sight, an incredible story, has overdone projections that the industry ever could have dreamed it would do. And so the Guild is finding winners that the audience is going to love. And we can predict what our audience score is going to be with the Guild score. We know whether it's going to be high 80s, low 90s, 90%+. And that's really powerful because we're not guessing on what the audience is going to want. They're telling us what they want.
I have a question, and this is coming from someone who also is in the world of entertainment. You know, in my case, particularly, it started out with just music and hip hop specifically. And it's a question that I get asked a lot, in a sense. I'm going to sort of rephrase it a little bit for this particular conversation. But what do you think is the, maybe this is two questions. A, what do you think is the role of entertainment media, and where do you think is the line between entertainment and cultural programming?
One of the things we say with like Tuttle Twins, for example, is someone will comment on one of our social media posts and they'll say, you guys are just programming culture. And our answer is, yes, we are, but we're upfront about it. Like, we're going to tell you exactly what this show is. We're not going to hide it. The Tuttle Twins is a kid's show about freedom and economics, and the people who don't want their kids to learn about freedom and economics, get them, you know, away from Tuttle Twins. So, I think there is an element of, you know, everything has an element of, the dirty word is indoctrination, or like getting people to be programmed in a certain way. You know, I prefer obviously the word influencing things to be, hopefully better for the world. There are some, you know, in my mind, definitive principles around, good versus evil. And so I feel like you can, is there a line where you can over influence someone to good? Yeah, I actually think there probably is, or over influence someone to evil. And I know that sounds contradictory, but you know, the Christian, for example, entertainment industry is not an entertainment industry that I loved very much for years and years and years, even being Christian, because it was so on the nose and it was so in your face and it was so, the quality of storytelling just wasn't that great. I was like, I don't want to watch this stuff. Like, I don't, it's not entertaining. It's not for me. And so in my mind, that's going, you know, and some, it's fine. It can exist, but it's not for me. It's going too far in terms of like jamming a message on my throat. And the same goes for, you know, what you, a lot of people would consider, and myself, woke ideology. Like, I don't want that jammed in my face all the time, or really ever. Because I think that those particular principles don't, you know, they don't do good for society. They actually hurt society in a negative way. But you can be divisive on the good side. Well, I mean, you can be in the right, and if you do, and if you communicate wrong, you can still be in the wrong. Meaning, I can say to someone, it's not good to kill. Everybody would agree with that statement. No one disagrees that killing someone is a good thing, but how I communicate that can actually be good or bad. And so, I don't know if that answers your question, but it definitely, you know, it's definitely one of those things where, we believe that the audience will keep us in check as to whether we're crossing that line. Cause they'll tell us, yeah, this content is going too far. And they'll pull us back in a meaningful way. And if they don't, and if the, as the Guild gets bigger and bigger to where it's millions and millions of members, that Angel Guild will become better at representing a broader and more diverse group of individuals, and they'll make better decisions for the whole. And so, Man, that is a really good question. I don't even know if I answered it right, but that's a fantastic question.
Thank you. Well, I don't think there's a right answer per se. I mean, it's one of those difficult ones where some of it becomes like a matter of conscience, right? Sorry, matter of conscience. And I think this is even true of individuals. So even if you look at Christians or people of faith in general, each individual has their own lines, right? Yep. Even in terms of what they themselves consume.
Exactly.
So you have
some drink alcohol, some don't. Yeah. It's a spectrum.
Same with the eyes and ears, right? So you'll have Christians who, you know, they won't listen to or watch anything secular, period. Even if it's secular and not you know, negative or profane, they're just like, nope, it has to be Christian. They'll only listen to gospel music. They won't even listen to secular music that is, you know, positive, right? So you've kind of got that. There's religious people who don't listen to music, period. And then you've got, you know, people who are, okay, cool, like I'll listen to. So myself, for example, I'm a rapper and I've been a rapper for, half my life at this point, which sounds crazy. So, you know, I don't swear. I don't swear in real life. I don't swear in my music. I don't use profanity, but I do listen to music that has profanity in it. Mm-hmm. I don't repeat those lyrics. And I have done since I was honestly like 12 years old. And there might be someone who thinks like, oh, no, like that's terrible. But I think I can fairly confidently say I don't think it influenced me in any sort of negative way. It was just like, you know, this is the music I like, and I actually like object to some of the things that are being said here, but I'll still some of it, like it's weird. Or even in terms of video games or movies and things like that, right? I can watch or consume something which I'm like, this goes against my core values, but I can separate the entertainment from the reality to a degree where, you know, I don't just watch something or play something and hear something, even from pretty young. And I'm going to go out there and repeat it, you know? But I guess everyone is just different in that.
I think everyone's not only different in that, but to me, it has to do with it's such an individual decision. Like, it's such a that's why I say I don't even fault people for, you know, enjoying the really great storytelling of Game of Thrones and House of Cards. Like, it's such compelling storytelling. And there's people who can't, like you said, they can kind of separate those two worlds of just, this is where I'm at. And this is where they're portraying this entertainment. But I think what's really interesting to me, and I heard from, I can't remember his name, but he actually was, a leader in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints where I attend. And he said, it's not about, you know, where you are, it's about your slope, right? Meaning if you're starting here in your life, and it's, you know, super high up, your parents are super wealthy, you've got everything going for you, and your slope is just a trajectory that's down towards negative, and it, like, you're just getting worse and worse as you go along in life, versus someone who starts way at the bottom of the pendulum and they work their way up and change their life and become a better and better person. Like, who's on a better trajectory? And so to me, it has less to do with where you're at and just more to do with, like, what's your trajectory? Are you trying to do good for the world? Are you moving in the direction that and for everybody, they're just in different places in their life, and that doesn't mean that one's in the wrong or one's in the right. It just means that they're in different places. Now, I obviously believe in absolute truth, like gravity's real, right? Killing someone's bad. But that being said, to your point, you know, I watched on VidAngel the Reacher series from Amazon. A lot of violence, a lot of swear, like, but it's a very entertaining show. A lot of action. I don't mind action as much and violence. I have an easier time with drawing from that and saying, well, obviously that's different than I do maybe like sexual content or whatever it may be. And so it's one of those things where everybody kind of has their own weaknesses and strengths and their vices, and being able to understand what those are for yourself and then drawing your own lines in a really meaningful way. That's powerful. Being able to say, hey, I know where my line is. I can go listen to rappers all day long. It's not going to affect the fact that I have my rap music the way I want to have it, you know, speaking for you. And so I love the way you articulated that.
Yeah, for sure. I think with me, the best way I could probably articulate my line personally And some of this is a sense or a feeling, you know. But I think for me, if I could articulate it, it would be I certainly avoid things and will sometimes turn something off if I think it is inverting good and evil. So if it is trying to convince you that evil is good or that good is evil, I think that's where my line is, right? So you can have depictions of all sorts of things, but what is the underlying morality? Is the are you meant to sympathize, like, you know, you should sympathize a little bit with the bad guy for it to be a bad guy, but is the you see what I mean?
You can understand him as a person and his motives and still know what he's doing is very evil. It's never portrayed in a way that's good. You know, a perfect example of this is The Schindler's List. That is one of the most difficult movies anybody could ever watch. I've watched it once. I'll probably never watch it again because it's so heavy and so hard to process. But it goes into some of the most grotesque and difficult things. But there is good and there is evil. Like, you know where those lines are. And that's where entertainment's really come in and muddied that. The amount of TV shows that I get into where I start enjoying the show, I start enjoying the story, I'm really liking the complexity of the protagonist, and I'm really liking the complexity of the antagonist. And then at the end, they're just the same person. And I'm like, what's going on? There isn't anybody to even cheer for at the end of this thing. So that's exactly right. That is a great barometer to just be like, are they making, and they do it in such subtle ways to where that you almost can't even distinguish when they're making evil look good and good look evil. And that is a true statement.
As a father of five, soon to be six, we can say father of six. I'll say
father of six.
How do you, firstly, what's the age range of your kids?
My oldest is 10 all the way down to just about to turn 2. And then the 0 obviously coming in a few weeks.
Okay. So when it comes to entertainment and media and content, How do you manage that with your children in this day and age?
So we're every time I get into this conversation, people are always like, why do you guys run a studio? We don't watch a lot of shows and films with our kids. We have movie day on Friday where we watch, you know, maybe one movie or an episode of a show. And we don't have our kids in social media. Like, for us, it's about getting out and playing in nature and just connecting with each other in a meaningful way. And so, I feel like right now is the time for them to learn how to explore their imagination and what they want to do. I don't want things to be imagined for them. I want them to be able to actually go through the process of imagining things. So I'd much rather have my daughter and my son, who are reading now really proficiently, reading books, and I wouldn't wanting them to, you know, watch a movie or a TV show. Now, that being said, you know, we'll still watch an occasional film. And if my wife's feeling super sick from being pregnant, she's, you know, we're not the perfect parents. We're not throwing our kids in front of the screen. We've totally done that. But that being said, it's the balance for us has always been at this stage in their life, they need to learn to develop their imagination and their creativity, and not have someone develop it for them. And so, you know, as much as I love good storytelling through the visual entertainment medium, the reality is it does the creativity for you to an extent, and to a large extent. And we want our kids to be kind of away from that. One of the things that we've really focused on is actually a curriculum or a methodology called the Well-Educated Heart, where the primary focus is around, it's less about academics and more about principles. So I was terrified of this because we actually homeschool our kids. And I was terrified of this when my wife was like, hey, this is a really interesting idea. But basically the premise was, we're not going to teach our oldest daughter. She's like 3 years old. She's like, we're not going to teach her how to read yet. And I was like, what? Like, we're not going to like teach her the basics of reading. She's like, we're going to read stories to her every night and all day whenever she wants to, and just read and read and read and read. So to our kids, we just read stories after story after story after story. And she said that the principle is that you get to a point where they fall in love with stories, and then they have context as to why reading is important, versus forcing them to memorize the principles of reading before they understand and value stories. They need to understand and value what that is for them in their life. And it was an interesting process because our, you know, our daughter, she was 5, wasn't reading, but loved stories. 6 wasn't reading, but loved stories. Between 6 and 7, she started asking questions about, hey, I'm kind of interested in learning about reading. So my wife started teaching her the different principles of reading, you know, where she was showing interest. And, but then she's like, in my brain, I'm freaking out because I'm like, my daughter's way behind and people are, all the kids her age are reading, you know, they're able to sound out words and, you know, X, Y, Z. And by 7, she was able to start reading by herself. And then all of a sudden it was like this hockey stick where she just took off. And it was an incredible thing to watch her going from 7 to 8 to where she was struggling to read. By the time she was 8, she was reading entire novels. And it's because she understood first the context and the principle that stories were meaningful and impactful to her in her life. And so we've been doing that with, you know, reading and math, making sure they understand, hey, when they go to the grocery store, why is math important? Why would you even need math? Oh, you can subtract and do X, Y, Z. But until they have the context, it just feels like a chore. It doesn't feel like learning. And so that's been our focus with our kids is leaning into educating their hearts and giving them context and allowing them to develop their own creativity.
That makes sense. It also sounds scary.
Oh, it's terrifying. what we realize is every day we parent, we're like, man, we are terrible parents, but I'm glad that we could hopefully there will be some grace as we go through all this process, but we're just failing our way through it.
Yeah. So I'm not a parent yet, but I talk to a ton of parents and all of my siblings are parents. I look at this modern time that we're living in. And of course we live in the age of something you mentioned, you know, before smartphones and social media. Have you and your wife, I'm sure you've thought about what your approach to this is going to be, but I like to just talk to different parents and see how either they're already doing it or what they have planned if they have younger kids when it comes to that, because I have seen the range from smartphones and social media, like the kids own from the age of 4. Mm-hmm. I think that's the youngest. And then other people, you know, some people 15, some people 16, some people, no, 18, you know, once they're out of the house and they can buy it themselves and get a job and whatever. How do you plan on handling that?
We actually are probably going to do it on a case-by-case basis because I feel like all of our children are just so different in their development and who they are. And so I don't think we're going to have a, you know, this is when we're going to allow them to have a smartphone or to have social media. Right now, I don't think any of our kids are close to that capacity of being able to manage that. And the reason I say that is because I feel like I have a hard time even managing that myself as a full grown adult who didn't even grow up with social media. I mean, it's just crazy addictive. I mean, it is so addictive. And so we're definitely leaning towards later than earlier. But I think our mentality has been, we feel like we'll know when they're ready. Meaning we'll be able to see the right behaviors and the right discipline to be able to manage that in their life. And that could be, you know, 12, 14, 16. I don't know when that's going to actually land. I do think there is, you know, we have one of those little watches that they can call us on and we'll probably get one of those dumb phones where they can call us on as they get older, if we still feel like they're not ready for social media or a smartphone. But that being said, I think anybody who puts hard lines in terms of, we're doing it this age, that's great. But maybe look at your kids when they get to that age and make sure that they're ready for that. Cause you might find that some are ready by that age and some aren't. You might find that some are ready before that. Like they're, you know, it really depends on the child. And so, you know, if I was to guess, my oldest daughter, she's extremely mature for her age. You know, she's probably going to be ready for it before my son is. And that's okay. They're just different personalities, and maybe I'm wrong on that too. You might find it's the exact opposite, but we probably as parents should come up with more definitive, like let's address it or have this conversation when they get to this age. But for us, it's just been at this point, our kids aren't even asking for it. mainly because they are constantly playing and going out, you know, hanging out with cousins and friends, and they're just getting to, my oldest two are just getting the age where they're going to start seeing their friends and cousins having that, those devices around. So I'm sure we'll start getting the questions now, but I definitely don't think, you know, kids under 10, it's a scary thing to put something that gives that much of a dopamine hit on a consistent basis for a child. That's a little terrifying.
Yep, I agree. As someone who has been on social media for 20 years at this point, I think it is, when someone tells me that their 9-year-old or their 5-year-old or that has like their own smartphone and full access to social media, I'm like, oh boy. Because I think I'm, because of how much time I've spent on it and spend on it, I think I'm very aware of certain things on there and the effects, more so than the average person is, even if they're a parent. It's just like it's a real portal into the entire world, even parts of the world you didn't even know existed.
I feel like the frontal lobe needs to be a little more developed. And jumping into that, I mean, we're a little older, so we probably got into social media a little later than what our kids could have, but the doom scroll is real for adults who didn't have social media growing up. That's going to be devastating. And it is devastating right now to the upcoming generation, where they're suffering from anxiety and depression and, you know, gender dysphoria and all these different things at rapid levels that have never been seen before. And in large part, it has to do with social media. They just don't know how to manage it. And they can't be blamed for that. Like you've got some of the world's best engineers trying to create algorithms that hook people on this. That's their goal, is like, how do we maintain people on our platform for as long as possible to get as much ad revenue as possible? And so they're just going to consistently find what's going to keep someone around. And for kids, that's a lot easier to do, because their barometer on what they, you know, the time they should be on there and whatnot is going to be much harder to manage. And so I'm totally with you. Like I can't even really imagine giving my kids social media at 12. I look at my kids right now and I'm like,
I think that's way too young.
It's just way too young. Like, you know, I probably, off of, you know, my own experience with it, which again, I didn't really have access to it until later in the latter part of high school. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's going to be a case by case basis, but I wouldn't be surprised if I have kids that don't get access to social media until they leave the house, because it's just one of those things where it's they just need to be able to develop that frontal lobe and their decision-making a little further before they can jump in and take on something that's as addictive as social media.
For real. Well, you talked about the engineers and the creators of the algorithms, and it's well known that a lot of them do not let their children.
100%.
I think that says a lot. And the fact that, if we're honest, most adults are at least somewhat addicted to their smartphone and social media. So if full-grown adults in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s are struggling with it, than the idea of giving it to a small child.
And I've found that I'm so much more disconnected from my family and my ability to like emotionally connect with them when I'm consumed into that, whether it's for work, because your smartphone also is work for me. And that yanks me in just like social media does in a lot of ways. And so it's been so powerful for me to come home lately. But this is something my wife and I've been doing, is I just go plug in my phone in the bedroom and then leave it. And the speed at which I start reconnecting with the individuals around me, it's powerful. There's something really powerful about just completely removing it from your life, out of your pocket. I mean, it's a real thing to say that you get the phantom vibrator in your pocket where you're like, oh, and you're like, oh, no, it's calling me. I don't have my phone on me. But it's wild. It's absolutely wild.
Slight diversion, but not completely. How did you meet your wife?
So I, when I was serving a mission in Mexico for our church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, my brother got married, my older brother than me got married to a girl. And then I got home, and in our faith, you go and you speak to the congregation about your experience for the 2 years and what you did. So I went to speak to our home congregation, and my brother came with his wife, who I had never met, and her sister happened to be in town from college and was like, hey, I want to hang out. And she's like, well, I'm going to my new brother-in-law's homecoming talk. You should come and just hang out with me there. So I met her. I was like, holy smokes. Like, I definitely want to know. Like, I didn't know that they were actually sisters. I was just like, who's that? They're not part of my home congregation. And I went and introduced myself, and we hit it off really well. And then I realized very quickly that they were sisters. And so it was, you know, that's how we met. But there was quite a few months actually where we didn't tell any of the family that we were exploring dating, and we were hanging out a lot because we didn't want it to be awkward if it didn't work out at family reunions for everyone else.
And so this is your sister-in-law.
This is my brother's wife's sister. So two brothers.
Brothers. Yeah. Yep. Sister-in-law's sister.
Yes, exactly.
Sister-in-law's
and,
sister.
And so you're like, that got really weird quick.
I didn't mean that.
Two brothers married two sisters, but we didn't tell anybody for a while that we were dating because we just didn't like, if this doesn't work out, I don't want this to be awkward at family reunions and different things for everybody else. So we're just going to keep it on the DL. And then once we realized, hey, we want to go further with this and pursue this relationship, we let everybody else know. But yeah, two brothers married two sisters, and it's been awesome. She's incredible. She's absolutely the anchor in our family. She's so disciplined in how she eats, how she wants to parent and educate our children. And I couldn't be more grateful for, I look at her as a co-founder of Angel as much as anybody else, because she's been absolutely remarkable.
I love that, man. Positive, inspiring words. So I want to talk a little bit about Sound of Freedom, because that was a huge movie. I mean, that was just so organic, the way it just sprung up, and the hype and the social media build and everything like that. I don't go to the cinema all that often, but I remember thinking like, I was in the UK, I think initially when it came out, and I was like, when I get to the US, I need to make sure that I go to the theater and I watch that, because I don't think it was out in the UK at the time. I thought the movie was awesome. The message, everything that it was highlighting, such an important, highly uncomfortable issue, but something that's extremely important and should be spoken about more. So tell me a little bit more about the movie. How did it come to be, and what was the reaction, and how did you guys respond to it?
Yeah, I mean, this movie's had such an incredible journey, because Eduardo Verástegui and Alejandro Monteverde and their team, they'd been doing this movie for over 8 years. And that's a really long time for a movie. I mean, it had been produced over 5 years before it was released, but it was in connection with Warner Brothers, not Warner Brothers, 20th Century Fox, I apologize. And they had produced it, and everybody's really excited about it. And then Disney comes in and acquires Fox, and for whatever reason, it gets shelved. You know, people can speculate as to why that is, but I think it's just as likely that someone just shelved it because they have so many things in their library and they didn't know what it was as someone being malicious. But that being said, it got shelved. And it took Eduardo over, I think, a year to buy the rights back from Disney and get the rights back. And then he tried to go and release it independently with a partner, and COVID hit right before they went out to release it, and it just fell flat. Couldn't get the financing to go do it. That contract expired, and we ran into Tim. We've been acquainted with him for years, but we didn't know him that well. But we ran into him at the Goshen set where The Chosen is shot. And Tim's like, hey, the rights for that movie about my life are about that mission are coming available. You know, would you guys be interested? And we're like, oh, we'd be interested for sure. I mean, we thought that opportunity is long gone, because we've known about the film for a long time. And so it was in March. Oh, excuse me. Let me backtrack just a little bit more. A few months earlier, Neil had gone and spoke at a conference in Mexico and happened to be on the same panel as Eduardo Verástegui, the producer of Sound of Freedom. And they met and connected and got along really well. And so there's all these little connection points that were happening. And then in March, early March of 2023, Tim reached out again and says, guys, I'm feeling a gravity towards this. I want to bring in Jim Caviezel, Eduardo, Jaime, all the producers, talent. Let's get everybody in the same room and see if we can work out a deal. And I was like, man, that would be great. and we got in the same room and we realized we were very quickly aligned on so many principles and things that we wanted to do with this film. And we weren't scared of it at all. Like a lot of other studios were, and that they're like, that's a heavy topic. No one's going to go watch that film. And so they ran it through the Angel Guild. The Angel Guild absolutely loved it. They were like, this has to get out to the world. And so for us, once the Angel Guild loves something, like, Angel's full steam ahead. Like we're like, audience loves it. Let's go. And so within 5 days of getting the whole teams together, we had locked in a distribution agreement, which is miraculous time. Like I've never seen that. Probably will never see that again. And then we were like off to the races. Okay, let's go for, you know, kind of an October release date or a September release date. But there was a few people in the company that were feeling very strongly that we needed to go earlier. They're like, we need to go earlier for some reason. I just feel like we need to go earlier. And we had discussions, well, maybe we go September. And they're like, no, I feel like it needs to go earlier. And we just kept having these discussions internally. And finally someone suggests, well, what if we go July 4th? And everybody, all the consultants we had brought in and different people, we had ex-executives from Disney, different people that were consulting us. And they were just like, we're out. Like, if you guys go July 4th, we're not going to be associated with this. We're not going to be associated with a failure. And then we sat down as a team and we said, you know, we're feeling like July 4th might be the day we need to go. But we, to be honest, I don't even think we understood. Our head of theatrical distribution, Brandon Purdy, who's incredible, he understood the implications of that date. But me personally, having never done theatrical before his only son and a couple of Chosen releases, I had never even contemplated the impact of July 4th and how competitive and difficult that date is. And so to get even 500 locations to allow you to come in on July 4th was like monumental, or 1,000. To land at 3,400 in our widest part of our release was absolutely a miracle. And there were so many things along the way where, you know, whether people believe in a divine or not, I believe that God made it so clear that he was involved in getting this out to the world because he wanted these kids to have a voice. He wanted that to be so clear. He didn't want any dispute as to whether or not he was the mechanism that allowed this to get out into the world. And because we had built a great theatrical business where we knew what our floor was, and we always could kind of predict what our floor is going to be so that we don't get our head over our skis in terms of how much we spend on marketing on a theatrical release. And we always expect our floor to anywhere between 7, 10, 15 million, kind of in that range. But we never expected, and we had, based on the pre-sales, we had projections that, oh man, Sound of Freedom could maybe do 40 million. Oh, maybe it could do 50 million. Oh, based on pre-sales, this is actually looking at 60 million. But to go to 250 million in the worldwide box office was not on anybody's bingo card. And it was a wild ride. Now we're not trying to actually replicate that on a regular basis. What we're trying to do is create a great theatrical release for each one of our films that's as profitable as possible and allows for them to continue in their downstream windows of streaming and DVDs and different things in a profitable way. And then if we have a breakout hit, that's great. It's exciting, but that's not what our business model is built off of. It's built off of creating a theatrical floor with all the Angel Guild members in our audience, to where we can predictably, release a movie in the theaters. And it's been a great partnership with all the, Regal and Cinemark and AMC, and they love what we're doing because, you know, 80-something% of films don't break $1 million in the box office. A24, which is like the gem of Hollywood, the 18 or 19% of their films have broken $10 million in the box office. Whereas with us, 90-something% of our films have broken $10 million. We've only had one film that's gone under it. And so we're excited. It's remarkable. But Sound of Freedom was clearly, there was a deeper thing happening there that was beyond our control.
Yeah. When I watched that, I just felt, wow. I don't know. It had a different feeling to it. I came out of that movie, and even while watching it, not just because of, I mean that in two ways, the content and the subject matter and the story itself is obviously very heavy, but I also think just in the world of cinema and entertainment, I was like, this is a shift. This is something different. And for this to happen independently and having some knowledge about the fact that, you know, it had been out there, but then it was shelved And that, I think that combined with the subject matter, combined with its commercial success, I was just like, okay, there's some shift happening. There's something, I don't know how to verbalize it, but this is very meaningful.
Yeah, I think entertainment, you know, I don't know exactly what it will look like in the next 5-10 years, but I wouldn't be surprised if people look back at, you know, there's the pre-COVID era of theatrical entertainment, the post-COVID era. For independent film and what we're doing with Angel, I think there is an element of people looking at the pre-Sound of Freedom and post-Sound of Freedom, because now you look at, you know, right after that we did After Death, which was the number one faith theatrical release in history. And then the shift, a sci-fi film, which, you know, had incredible reviews and did really well as well for a small independent film. And this shift in the entertainment space is healthy, because it allows for the big studios to look at and say, okay, there's clearly a huge underserved audience that's feeling like what we're creating for them isn't resonating. And so now you're seeing Amazon and Netflix and all these different big studios and Disney, well, maybe not Disney yet, but a lot of these big studios that are pivoting their content strategy. I was like, I was saying a few weeks ago, I'm like, I think Disney might have like woke up and they're pivoting. And then they released Acolyte. And I was like, no, they're still not there. they're still releasing crazy stuff. So they're a lot of them are waking up, and some will die off and some will innovate and be able to like adapt. But it's going to be good, because that means that even if Angel, although our goal is to become, you know, one of the biggest studios in the world, even if Angel doesn't ever get there, the entertainment industry is shifting to meet the need that Angel is showing exists. And so that's really powerful.
Tell the audience a little bit more about The Sound of Hope, the new movie.
Yeah, Sound of Hope is the story of Possum Trot, Texas, this incredible family, this couple who started this movement inside their community, where 22 families adopted 77 kids out of the foster system. And when you look at this film's very hard to watch. There was a reviewer that said this film will tear you apart and then beautifully put you back together at the end. And so it's one of those things where this film has a totally different tone than anything we've ever done before. It's not like any other movie we've ever done distributed before. And our partners, the director, Josh Weigel, and his production company with his wife, Rebecca Weigel, Peachtree, they've done such an incredible job with this movie, to where it's scoring one of the highest scores we've ever seen in the Angel Guild. And it's something where if you look at that, there's 100,000 kids in the United States who are without a home, and there's 400,000 churches and, you know, 100+ million families there. The numbers don't add up. Like, you can solve this problem if you can bring enough awareness to what's happening. And so our goal is that we can enlist 1 million fighters for July 4th, people who are going to fight for these children, who are going to find a way to, whether it's through resources or through adoption or through whatever means they have, people will know for themselves what they can do, because it's going to be different for each individual. Everybody has different skill sets, different capacities in life and what they're doing, but getting the awareness is the number one step to solving a problem. And so July 4th, Sound of Hope, the Possum Trot, the story of Possum Trot is going to be something that I believe will move millions of people to step up and solve this problem. And again, the foster crisis is a source of a lot of other problems. When you look at the incarceration rate of kids that come out of the foster system, the drug abuse, the child sex abuse, the different things that they're going through, it's a completely broken system. And no child, every child deserves a home. They just deserve to have a home and a family, a mother and a father, if at all possible. And that's not, you know, not every family can have a mother and father, and I get that, but we can do better than what we're doing. And what's happening with the fatherless epidemic is contributing to a lot of this, where dads aren't stepping up. They need to step up. They need to be there for their kids in a really, really meaningful way. And I think this film is going to inspire millions.
I love that, man. Dude, every time you speak, like, my brain jumps to so many different places and things that are fascinating. I mean, talking about the fatherlessness issue, I think I've said this many times on many podcasts, is that I think that is arguably the biggest problem in America.
I would agree.
At least social problem. And I think what's strange about it is how I do understand why people are uncomfortable discussing it. And I think because it's so common, it feels like it implicates so many people, right? I think that now that that's, I don't know the number, but we could be, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if in the US, by some definition, if about 50% of people.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me at all. Would not surprise me at all.
About 50% of people are, you know, coming from some type of broken home or single parent situation. And so it makes people incredibly sensitive, because when you talk about it, people, number one, sometimes feel targeted and take it personally. But also I find that people don't hear what you're saying. It's interpreted differently. So if you say that it's better for a child to have a mother and a father, which is the most obvious statement someone can say, what some people hear is all single mothers are bad, or all people raised by a single parent are bad. Or it's like that wasn't the statement. Why can't we just,
you can have a wonderful single mother and still be true that a father and mother would be better.
Yes.
But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't take away from what you're trying to do. It is really hard to have those conversations. Officer Tatum, an influencer that you might be aware of, we met with him, and he has these shirts that say "Fathers Matter," and I just loved it. I was like, man, this is such a good shirt. And it's one of those things where people just need to understand that, like, culturally, men are being degraded in a way that, you know, is pretty remarkable right now, in terms of like the most recent, you know, speaking of Acolyte, apparently apparently there's like a scene of like two lesbians or something having immaculate conception or something. It was just like the weirdest thing ever. But that being said, it's one of those things where when they're trying to just write out and say, yeah, we don't need you. We don't need a man in our lives. And that's one of those things where it goes back to what you're saying, making good look like it's evil and evil look like it's good. Now, evil is maybe not the right word to use for this context, because, you know, stuff happens. People sometimes aren't able to have a father and a mother in their household. But the best situation for any child, the greatest privilege any child can have, is having a mother and a father. It is the greatest privilege available. That's why when people say, oh, you grew up in poverty and you guys didn't have, you know, TV, you didn't have XYZ, all these different things. You had to pay for your own schooling. You had to pay for your own life, like what, your own shoes a lot of times. Like, you guys must have had it really bad. And I'm like, I had a loving mother and a loving father.
Yeah. It's a sign of the decadent times and just a very decadent era to even be questioning some of the things that are being currently questioned in the USA and other Western countries. I mean, when you're having debates about if it's better for a kid to have both parents, or you're debating what a man even is or what a woman even is. I mean, that's just a very, I don't even know how to explain it. It's just bananas, right?
You're setting the table. Like, it's like going into a dinner and you're setting the table and saying, okay, well, we're actually going to put all the plates down and then we're going to put the tablecloth over the plates. And everybody goes, well, wait, that's not how, no. This is how we start. This is the starting point of this discussion and this dinner setting. It's like, no, but this is not how the table is supposed to be set. Like, and so that's how these debates are being set up, is they're just setting them up under a premise that's just a false premise, period. And it causes for people to feel hurt and disrespected, when in reality, you know, truth should not be something that people look at subjectively. And our culture is getting to a place where it's just saying, oh, so, you know, truth's subjective. And that's just not accurate. It's an inaccurate statement. It's a dangerous statement. And it's really a culture wrecking statement.
Absolutely. Jordan, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I love the work that Angel Studios is doing. I've watched tons of Tuttle Twin.
You're awesome.
Thank you so much, man. Thank you. I love your movies. I haven't seen all of them yet, but I plan to watch more of them. I can personally endorse The Sound of Hope. I may have had a preview to watch the movie. I can tell
it's,
my audience.
It's unlike anything we've done before. It's, you know, don't expect, yeah, you know, Jim Caviezel going and, you know, kicking someone down. But this film, again, the best sentence I have for it is that review that said this film will tear you apart and then beautifully put you back together at the end. And so just know that there is, it's a beautiful film. Bring a tissue box, go to angel.com/hope, get out there. This film, we need a million fighters for July 4th.
Amazing. Jordan, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Brother. Really appreciate you. Take care.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.